Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is On Point, a horror show. That's how President Trump described elephant hunting back in November, said it would be difficult for anyone to change his mind. But earlier this month, his Interior Department quietly reversed an Obama-era ban on elephant and lion trophies. Defenders say Americans traveling abroad for big game hunting prevents poaching, promotes conservation, and brings economic development. But critics argue that the president's new advisory council on wildlife conservation is stacked with trophy hunters who only care about the big bucks of big game. This hour, On Point, trophy hunting and the Trump administration. You can join us on air or online. Is it now open season for hunters? What do you make of President Trump's comments and his reversal? Are there benefits of trophy hunting? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me via Skype from Reston, Virginia, is Michael Biesecker, an investigative reporter with the Associated Press who writes about the environment. He was at Friday's meeting of the International Wildlife Conservation Council. Michael, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Kim. Good to be with you.
So before we get started, let's go back to January when President Trump told British television host Piers Morgan why he overruled a decision by his own Interior Department last November to lift restrictions related to importing elephant trophies from Africa.
I didn't want elephants killed and stuffed and have the tusks brought back into this. And people can talk all they want about preservation and all of the things that they're saying, where money goes toward, well, money was going, in that case, going to a government which was probably taking the money, okay?
So, Michael, there was a ban, and then there wasn't, but then there was again, and now there's not. Explain how we got here and where we are right now.
Well, the Obama administration placed virtually a ban on imports of elephant trophies, I believe, in 2014, and strictly limited the import of lion trophies, except from South Africa, where there are more of them. But there were powerful interests wanting to expand the countries where lions could be taken to Zimbabwe and Zambia, as well as Tanzania, and import those into the United States. Those countries are popular with big game hunters. And also, they wanted to get elephant trophies into the country. So there was a coordinated lobbying effort on behalf of the Safari Club International and the National Rifle Association to file test permits during 2016 that they could then challenge the Obama-era ban. But with the election of President Trump, they got Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, himself a hunter and arguably far more friendlier to their point of view. And in October, Zinke's Interior Department, the Fish and Wildlife Service, did quietly lift the ban on lion trophies from Zimbabwe and Zambia. They issued 37 permits for trophies shortly after the ban was lifted. And then in November, the elephant ban was lifted. And that got a lot more attention. There was a public backlash, and that prompted President Trump to intervene and issue the tweet where he described trophy hunting as a horror show.
And since then, just earlier this month, there was another quiet reversal allowing this kind of hunting to take place on a case-by-case basis. Is there any regulation on it at all, or are we back to where we were pre the Obama-era order?
Well, in December, a federal judge, as part of the lawsuit filed by the Safari Club International and the National Rifle Association, did rule that the Obama-era ban did not take into account enough public comment and public views before writing the regulations that they did. Zinke's Interior Department has interpreted that ruling to be that they are once again free to lift the ban on elephant trophies, which is what they did in early March. And then pointing at that ruling, they are going to basically rewrite the Obama-era regulations into new regulations with the help of the new board that Secretary Zinke has appointed, which met Friday.
And tell us about that new advisory commission, the International Wildlife Conservation Committee that Secretary Zinke put together. You were at their first meeting on Friday. Tell us what happened.
Well, prior to the meeting, the Associated Press researched the backgrounds and social media posting of the 16 appointees that Zinke selected for the council. And 14 of the 16 are either lobbyists for hunting organizations like the Safari Club or the National Rifle Association, the president of the Safari Club, board members of various hunting groups, or they're big game hunters themselves, either TV personalities who have hunting shows or are have a large online following for their hunts, or people who are wealthy Americans who, you know, trophy hunting is an expensive sport. It can cost up to $50,000 or more to go on an elephant hunt for 2 weeks in Africa. So, you know, those are the folks that make up the majority of the board. The two remaining members, one is a former zoo director with expertise in importing wildlife that's alive, which also requires a fish and wildlife permit. And the other is a veterinarian who has ties to a family ranch that's in the wildlife trade, raising lemurs, kangaroos, and others. And they've had some issues at that ranch that Florida Fish and Wildlife Service has cited them for.
All right. And joining us now from Dallas, Texas, is Chris Hudson. He's a member of the International Wildlife Conservation Council and a big game hunter himself and past president of the Dallas Safari Club. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Kim. Pleasure to be with you.
So tell us first about your own background with hunting. When did you start and what kind of hunting do you do?
Well, I was born in Dallas, Texas, and I started hunting with my family before I was 5 years old. My brother and sister and mother and father, we would hunt every year for dove and quail and deer and turkey. That's how we got started, and it was a part of everything that our family did throughout my entire life.
And so as a member of this advisory council, what are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, the secretary formed the council in order to advise him about the role that hunters can play in the international arena. And I think it's time for an honest discussion about the big policy questions of what we're doing on this planet with the decline in the biomass. We have more than 7 billion humans moving fast towards 10 billion, and we have declining habitat areas and wild areas and biodiversity loss. And the current systems, by all objective measures, are there's a competition between humans and wildlife, and the hunting community can play a role in that and has played a role in that. And we can look here in the United States to the best success of what we call the North American model, where we've preserved wildlands and wild places. And I think what the secretary is looking for is some recommendations about whether we can export the successes of that model to the world community.
Now, Chris, you know, there has been a lot of pushback to allowing particularly big game trophy hunting, questions about the profiteering that could take place, also the politics. It was a photo of Donald Trump Jr. As he was with carcasses of animals he hunted in Africa that sparked some controversy. He spoke with CNN about what he sees as big game hunting's benefits to conservation efforts while hunting pheasants during the 2016 Iowa caucus. Let's take a listen.
When you look at the amount of money generated by conservationists, about the amount of land that's put aside to save these kind of the habitat for those animals, all of that's driven by hunters. I mean, starting back in the days of Theodore Roosevelt, who was, you know, the original guy setting aside federal lands for that purpose.
How do you explain to our listeners who may be upset when they see images of these animals being killed how it's actually beneficial?
Well, the scientific model that informs the regulation of sport hunting here in America gives us those answers. You know, here in America, we have about 4.5% of our land mass that's reserved in park areas. But those park areas could not function without the areas surrounding the parks, which are largely in private hands. And it is in those lands where regulated sport hunting occurs in all 50 states. And as a result, we have, for the most part, very, very healthy populations of big game, which is hunted on a regular basis, that nobody's really concerned about is going endangered or going extinct. That system works because of the user pays model. The fact of the matter is that hunters care very much about their sport, and they want to be able to pass on that tradition such that their children and their grandchildren can do the same. And that would not happen if they were wantonly out there killing all the animals. So the idea that we could just preserve the animals, put them in a park, is nonsensical. In Yellowstone Park, without the winter migration lands around it, all the animals would die. Mm. And the same is true in Africa and other places around the world. While the Serengeti and Kruger and Chobe are wonderful park systems, or Grand Roseau, without the monstrous lands and acreage around them, those ecosystems would fail and all the animals would starve.
Well, Chris, I want to pause right there because we have a caller from South Africa. Rosemarie is on the line. Hi there, Rosemarie.
Hi, Kim. How are you?
I'm good. What's your comment?
So I'd like to address a couple points if I have the time. First, the conversation around the trophy hunting of elephants, from my point of view, the first imperative should be an ethical and moral consideration. Secondly, there is a widespread dispute of the argument that trophy hunting benefits local communities in South Africa and the other African nations that support trophy hunting. Now it is factual that a very, very small percentage of the resources garnered from trophy hunting are allocated to local communities. However, I deal with local communities. I work with them. I'm an American living in rural South Africa on behalf of a small conservation organization called the Global March for Elephants and Rhinos. And in my interactions with local people, the idea that trophy hunting actually benefits them is laughable.
Well, Chris, I want to give Chris, in the 20 seconds before our break, just a quick opportunity, and then we'll come back afterwards.
Sure. I think you can look at South Africa as a shining example of where hunting has saved wildlands and wild species. In 1950, there were less than 500,000 game animals in South Africa. Today, there's only 30 million. And all the jobs that are produced as a result of that, they're a result of trophy hunting. Those animals and those employees are there because of the trophy hunting community. That's a success story that we'd like to extend to other countries.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins, and we're talking about trophy hunting, wildlife conservation, and the Trump administration. You can join the conversation. Do you think big game hunting in Africa helps protect lions, elephants, and rhinos from poachers? Does it help prop up developing countries that could use the influx of cash? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking to Michael Biesecker, an investigative reporter with the Associated Press, who's been covering this story, and Chris Hudson, who's on the International Wildlife Conservation Council and a past president of the Dallas Safari Club. Chris, I wanted to give you a chance to finish your thought about the concerns that Rosemarie raised.
Sure. So I think Rosemarie was talking about the fact that there's what I believe a myth out there that hunting is not conservation, that there's no benefit to local communities. You need not look any further than the success that we've had here in North America in the last 100 years. At the turn of two centuries ago, in the early 1900s, we had our major big game animals on the verge of extinction. The numbers of moose, elk, pronghorn, and white-tailed deer and turkey were far more dire than what we look at in any of the major animal populations in Africa today. And what the community did at the time, because there was no Endangered Species Act and there were not activist animal rights groups, is they looked to the sport hunting community. And they asked for a user pay system who asked to be taxed. With the Pittman-Robinson Act passed in 1937, we instituted game wardens, regulations, seasons, game management, and science-based wildlife management. Mm. Fast forward 100 years later, There were less than 500,000 whitetail in North America. Today, there are tens of millions. In Texas, more than 500,000 are harvested every year on a sustainable basis, and that provides jobs, it provides employment, it raises the value of land, which increases tax revenue for the counties, that benefits schools and communities.
All right.
The same can be said in South Africa, as I mentioned before the break. In the 1950s, there were less than 500,000 wild game animals left in South Africa. Less than 70 years later, there's 20 to 30 million. It happened because of a change in policy. The privatization of wildlife, the encouragement of regulations to support ranching for wildlife, and the sport hunting community to bring American hunters to Africa has been the genesis of that success story. And if you define success by healthy populations of wild game for future generations, which is what we all talk about and what we care about, because we want 100 years from now and 200 years from now for there to be wild, free-ranging populations of these animals, North America and South Africa are shining examples of where this works. And it's
right.
funded by
Chris, I
want to
pause you.
Community.
Yeah, I want to pause just right there because joining us now from Washington is Masha Kalanina, an international trade policy specialist with the Humane Society International. Masha, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Kim.
So I want to get your reaction to what Chris was saying, the arguments in favor of game hunting and how it helps conservation efforts.
Well, I'd love to first make a broad point and then address the North American model that Chris has brought up and talk about South Africa. I think no one disagrees that we have a crisis on our hands with a declining habitat, exploding human populations in Africa, human-wildlife conflict, poaching. Everyone agrees that these are very serious issues. And if this is something that hunters care about, then spend that money. Help us set aside that land. Help us, in a philanthropic way, pay for that land. Invest in sustainable green utilization of these lands, but don't slaughter wildlife. You don't only have to have one with the other. The North American model, well, actually, a study in 2014 demonstrated that 95% of federal and 94% of total funding for wildlife conservation in the United States comes from non-hunting public. So the other issue is we have yo-yo conservation in the United States. So we basically drive species to the brink, and then we list them, and then we delist them so hunters can drive them back down to the brink of extinction. In the United States, we permit killing of bears in their dens, the same for wolves, and we kill animals from helicopters. Pregnant bear females are killed by trophy hunters. Trophy hunters chase cougars with dogs up into trees so they can shoot them more easily. It's horrific. Just really quickly on the South Africa point, just because you have one example, we've had hunting and species have recovered. Chris is claiming that's a direct causation. There may be correlation there, but their success for South Africa is completely because of their tourism success and they're extremely profitable in terms of their ecotourism, non-consumptive tourism. The other issue is there's a perfect example of where trophy hunting hasn't worked in South Africa, and that's with leopards. In 2016 and 2017, South Africa prohibited exports of leopard trophies from that country. Why? Because they don't have any idea of how many leopards they have. They don't have the science to back up a sustainable quota.
Well, Masha, I want to pause you right there just so we can get to some of the many callers that we have, including Joe calling from Buffalo, New York. You're a hunter, Joe.
Yes, Kim. I belong to the Western New York Safari Club. I live in a little town of Clarence outside of Buffalo. And I just give you an example. I did kill an elephant in Zimbabwe several years ago. And I hunted in a block that of territory where they had recently flown in 16 endangered black rhinos so that they would be under the protection of the outfit that controls the block. Now, when you're in a hunting block, for the most part, there's oftentimes, in fact, usually, anti-poaching outfits that what they do, not only do they go after the poachers, but much of Africa was farming country, especially raising livestock. So there's wires everywhere, and they're used to catch all kinds of animals. I've seen baby giraffes. I've seen all kinds of animals in these wires. And the anti-poaching units go out, they stop the poaching, and they take these wires and destroy them. Now, I'm going to give you an instance on this elephant that I killed. First of all, this elephant had been raiding the tomato patches and corn of the natives. What happens in that situation, the government will fly in with gunships and maybe kill 20 or 30 of the elephants with no money going to the villagers. With my elephant, within a half an hour of that elephant being on the ground, no less than 150 natives showed up in pickup trucks, donkey carts, and everything else. The guys from the safari group, the safari company,
Yeah. They
cut all the meat up, and the next day, it was amazing how much of this meat was drying for the villagers.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for calling in. I want to give Masha a chance to react to that. This hunter is saying that he's seeing this be a benefit.
Well, Africans don't need meat handouts, they need jobs. And we see that ecotourism in 8 African countries we studied brings in 2.6 million jobs, and trophy hunting is about 7,500 jobs, maybe even less. What we see in Zimbabwe specifically, and I'm glad the caller brought this up because there's a crisis there, actually they've lost 6% of their elephants since 2001, and they permit trophy hunting in areas where the poaching is highest, in the mid-Zambezi area and in Simbungwe. Where you have to apply precautionary principle when you have an offtake, because tourism is a source of direct mortality. And so another study in 2016 by Maposhi said that the tusk size of elephants that are trophy hunted in Metetsi is declining, because that's a consequence of selective offtake by trophy hunters of the animals with the largest tusks.
Michael, I want to bring you back in here. We've heard some different perspectives. How do you think that this these different perspectives are being heard by the Trump administration, and what actions might we see next?
Well, there's a Federal Advisory Committee Act that ordains that the federal advisory committees, like the Wildlife Council, have to be made up of a fairly balanced mix of viewpoints. And I think that the environmental groups and the animal rights groups would argue that they are not represented on that council. Now, Secretary Zinke's spokeswoman claimed that it does balance all points of view, but that's all points of view within the sphere of trophy hunting that they appointed, not necessarily people who think that hunting might not be ethical for these large animals. An example you often hear pointed to is Teddy Roosevelt, you know, a great American. But when Teddy Roosevelt was hunting elephants in Africa in 1900, there were around 5 million. And now that number's down to around 300,000, depending on what the study you look at. And they're losing about 50,000 a year to primarily to poaching. But hunting does take an impact. Hunters, as Masha pointed out, tend to target the largest specimens within a species group. So they're the largest, strongest animals, and it does impact the population to have them gone.
Well, Chris, what's your reaction to that point and the idea that this advisory group is not balanced?
Well, I think it's a classic example of junk science. The notion that hunters are responsible for a genetic modification of species because we target the large and the strongest is patently absurd. With the notion of shooting animals near the end of their life, post-breeding age adult males have been breeding their entire life. So the notion that gene transfer does not get passed through just doesn't pass muster. There are a number of studies that show that's different. The notion that in 10 or 15 years that there could be some difference in tusk size in a particular region on animals that live on an average of 55-year lifespan doesn't make sense to me. I'm not familiar with that particular study, but I don't think that's germane to the question.
And what about the idea of the makeup of the advisory council, Chris? What do you say to that?
Well, we've met one time. Many of those people I met for the very first time last Friday. There are two people on the committee that, as previously discussed, are not hunters at all. They represent the scientific community, the veterinary community, and the zoological community. In respect to the others, yes, there are a lot of hunters there, and I think that's appropriate because, as we've demonstrated here in the United States, it's the hunting community that historically has funded the conservation research that pays for the biologists in all 50 state game agencies. That's a representative view of the people who have been taking care of wildlife in the United States.
Chris is calling from Portage, Wisconsin. Hi there, Chris.
Hi, great show. I just, I am a subsistence hunter. My daughter kept us in meat this winter hunting rabbits, And I have to point out that land that was open to us, now managed by the Humane Society of the United States, is not. And the Humane Society is a strictly anti-hunting, by any means necessary, organization, and that bias needs to be pointed out. But I'm in favor of this regulation change because I would love to go to Africa and hunt a kudu and bring it home after experiencing that hunt of a lifetime and share that feast, which is my real trophy, with my friends and family. And the burdensome regulation of an imports, it's not possible at this time. And so liberalizing the trophy import will hopefully liberalize the meat import, which is what I care about.
All right, Chris, thank you for that call. Masha, what do you say to folks like Chris who are hunters? They may not be big game hunters, but they worry that the rules against that can encroach on what they do.
Well, first I want to clarify is that Humane Society of the United States does not oppose hunting for subsistence, just to make that clear. But I want to flag for the caller that there has been rampant corruption among the files of the trophy hunters in all countries where they operate in Africa. And that's what we fear most, as this council, this laughable council with no experts on conservation, will seek to expand trophy hunting in these countries. I want to read one quote from the 2012 Minister of Natural Resources in Tanzania, Ambassador Khamis Kakadeshi. He said, and this was him addressing trophy hunters, the Tanzania Safari Outfitters Association. He said, "You have a lot of cash, that much I know. Some of you have become sources of bad influence to government officials. Please stop bribing them and let them perform their duties professionally." And in Zimbabwe, actually, we just earlier this year had the entire Wildlife Authority board dismissed because of corruption. And last year, the director of wildlife there was fired for his involvement in rhino trafficking scams. So what we see trophy hunters is they are fueling corruption in these countries as they seek to dominate these hunting blocks. And they're keeping out other sustainable uses and ecotourism opportunities from these countries.
Well, Safari Club International, the international hunting organization, has long supported loosening restrictions on importing trophies. Let's listen to a clip from one of their many hunting YouTube videos where five men discuss the joys of hunting while sitting on the body of a lioness they killed.
If you have any opportunity to come to Africa, you need to do that. This is an opportunity of a lifetime. This is actually my ninth trip over here. You never get tired of it. And most first-time African hunters, you know, they think they're going to do this one time. And what happens, Stephen?
You come back and you come back and you come back.
Now, Chris, you know, images like that, again, they can be disturbing to people. Do you think that's the right message to be sending for people who support game hunting?
I think the right message is to encourage Americans to travel abroad and hunt, because the range nations where the animals that we're talking about are so concerned, it's nice to talk about Kruger or maybe Wangi Park, but the areas where hunters have these blocks are not suitable to photo tourism. Photo tourism in the Okavango Delta is a wonderful thing, but the Ngami land to the east and south and up into the Angola lands, nobody could have a profitable ecotourism business there. And so it is the hunting community that goes to these areas that provides the anti-poaching patrols. And so trophy hunting is the least impact that you can have on these wild places that aren't particularly gorgeous like Yosemite or Yellowstone. Mm-hmm. And the truism is that if nobody is there, if the hunters aren't there, the locals in those communities are not employed. They revert to poaching. And the wildlife traffickers, who are the real problem, who are, you know, for commercial export of elephant and rhinoceros, they have no barriers to going in and wiping out the entire population. That's the ultimate protection on those far, far away lands. And the trophy hunting community provides that throughout sub-Saharan Africa.
All right. I want to get to Liz on our line from Spearfish, South Dakota, before our break. Hi, Liz.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. Go ahead. Just a few seconds before our break.
Okay. Yes. As I'm listening to the pro-trophy hunters, you know, after studying epidemiology and statistics at South Dakota State University and Black Hills State, I'm realizing that these pro-trophy hunters are using statistics to sway their views, the public, to make it seem like this is okay. Hunting for food is fine. It's very popular here in Western South Dakota, tradition of family members that do this together. Hmm. And as a earlier caller said, they have $50,000 to spend on a sport. Why not find another hobby, help people protect our state parks, wildlife? You know, think of this pragmatically. They're eventually going to kill all these beautiful animals, and they will become extinct. They're just trying to justify their trophy hunting, which I think is actually obscene.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins, and we're talking about the economics and environmental concerns of big game hunting after the Trump administration lifted a ban on some elephant and lion trophies. You can join the conversation. Should big game hunting be reined in or allowed to continue? What's the right way forward? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Associated Press investigative reporter Michael Biesecker, Masha Kalinina from the Humane Society International, and Chris Hudson, a past president of the Dallas Safari Club and a current member of the Trump administration's International Wildlife Conservation Council. Now, Michael, I want to get back to the point made by Liz from South Dakota about the use of statistics in all of this. What have you seen in your reporting?
You know, both sides point to studies that buttress their point of view. One interesting perspective that I did hear discussed amongst the council members on Friday is that big game animals only have an inherent financial value because of hunting, and only what people will pay in fees to hunt them. And without that value placed on their heads, that no one would pay for conservation and anti-poaching efforts. When Chris was leading the Dallas Safari Club, they held a raffle that an individual paid $350,000 for a permit to kill a black rhino in Namibia. Now, black rhinos are critically endangered. There's only 5,000 left in the world. So the idea that trophy hunters are interested only in conserving these animals so that they then may hunt a portion of them, it's an interesting phenomenon that the fewer of these animals there are left, the more folks want to hunt them.
Chris, what do you say to that?
I think you ought to ask the Namibian government and MET about where they get their funding for their black rhinos and how successful their black rhino program has been. And the reason why we're even talking about black rhinos in Namibia is because of the hunting program there. The HSUS does not fund the anti-poaching efforts for the Namibian government and their black rhinos. It's a fantastic success. And yes, we auctioned off, Dallas Safari Club did, the rights that the Namibian government asked us to auction off so that they could get the funding to help their program. The individual rhinoceros that was harvested in that scenario, I had actually seen and been on that ranch. And that rhinoceros was past breeding age. It was personally responsible for killing three or four rhinoceros and young females and young breeding males on that same ranch. So if the idea on animal husbandry is you want to grow the population, then you ought to listen to the scientists who are engaged in that animal husbandry. And if what you want is breeding age males and females, you ought to take away the old post-breeding age males that are killing off your breeding males and females. That's what's happening in Namibia. And the money that came from that hunt funds that scientific research and funds everyone involved in that program. And it's a very successful program.
I want to turn for a second about the political crises and the role that they play. Speaking with the Associated Press back in November, Shea Wolf, a biologist with the Center for Biological Diversity, discussed the lead-up to the ouster of Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe and how political crises can lead to an increase in poaching.
Zimbabwe is in the midst of a political coup. Its government is in upheaval. It's in crisis. And we know from in times of upheaval that poaching increases and that there's no way for the government to effectively manage hunting, much less rein in poaching.
Masha, talk about that, how political crises play into the issue of game hunting.
Well, it's, of course, a destabilizing force in an industry that's already so corrupt and poorly regulated as it is. So certainly a situation like a coup can only undermine that. I do just really want to quickly address the rhino that was brought up. It's claimed often that he was beyond the breeding age. Just like a human male, actually rhinos are able to breed well into their old age. The behavior that was described is an example of that being a dominant rhino, and it's his genetics that should be passed down to the future generations. And we have no examples of how that $350,000 was actually spent. There's actually an increase of rhino poaching in Namibia at the moment. And in terms of hunters going out and only hunting in remote areas that no one wants to go to, that's just not true. If you go to their websites, you see that most of the hunting blocks are outside of Hwange, they're outside of Selous, because they depend on healthy ecosystems to source continued flow of wildlife so they can kill it. And also they bring their families out there. So what do they want to do? They want to be in remote areas? No, they want to go see in Victoria Falls and visit tourist sites. So no, that's just not true.
All right, Jody is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Thanks for calling, Jody.
Hi, Kim. Thanks. I just want to say that it's just really heartbreaking to hear about these new regulations on trophy hunting. I'm an advocate here in Kentucky for nursing home residents, so my heart really goes out to vulnerable populations who can't protect themselves. And this absolutely extends to the animal populations, these vulnerable populations that people are just killing off. You know, we've got a moral and ethical responsibility as humans to protect these populations. And politics, statistics, money aside, you know, we're obligated to protect these animals. I have a 2-year-old daughter, and I don't want her to grow up in a world that doesn't have giraffes and elephants and the things that I love to go and look at in books and online. I don't want her to just be able to go and read about those in books. I want her to, you know, be able to see these animals.
Yeah, Jody, thank you for your call. And we also have listeners joining the conversation on Twitter. Melvina writes, trophy hunting takes out the best specimens of species and negates survival of the fittest. Animals thrived for millions of years without help from hunters. And from our website, Mark wrote, isn't saying that trophy hunting is necessary in order to pay for wildlife conservation like saying that child prostitution is necessary in order to pay for child welfare programs? Chris, what do you say about the concerns raised by our listeners?
I think they're uninformed. The fact of the matter is that if we care about future populations of wild game, and I agree with Jody, I want my children and grandchildren to be able to see wild and free-ranging animals in the sub-Saharan continent. That will not happen if we don't protect the ecosystems where those animals live today. And the fact of the matter is, you know, I was amused at Masha talking about the wild areas where people want to take their families, because I doubt if she's ever been to the Selous. I mean, there's 15 million acres in the southern part of Tanzania that cost $10,000 charter flight to get there. It is a wild place. There's hardly anything out there. And it's a perfect environment for the criminal element. Without the trophy hunters there, the criminal element is unfettered in their ability to harvest every single living thing in that ecosystem. And that's exactly what happens. And we have lots of very, very sad situations where we can point to the extinction of every living species and the destruction of an ecosystem once the hunting operators were removed. And you end up with grazing, pastoralism, and human encroachment. And that is why we're losing the biomass that we are. And that's why the IWCC was created. Because if we can all agree that 50 and 100 and 150 years from now, we need to preserve these habitats, we need to find the answers as to what the best economic solutions are. And there's a good system here in the United States and in South Africa that shows that the people who care about those very far distant wild lands are the hunters.
Masha, I want to give you a chance to respond.
Sure. Well, I did actually see a full spread in the Safari Club International magazine on about a family trip to hunt in Africa, where even the children got to hunt their own first African animal. So these are very much family trips. Absolutely, extinction is a threat to these species, and we need to be keeping as many of them alive as possible. One lion can bring in $1 million in terms of ecotourism funds. And in fact, what we have are examples of hunters killing basically children lions, so 2 years and younger, in Tanzania for decades. And there was a scientist, Craig Packer, who was actually expelled from the country for exposing this corruption. You even had the taxidermist sewing putting on manes onto these baby lions. So hunters don't really know when to stop, and they always want more. And only after regulations were put in to restrict age did the hunters actually begin to kill older lions, but they still kill them at about 5 or 6 years, even though the lions live until 13 or older. So the livestock issue, farming is not necessarily incompatible with wildlife conservation. You have to have responsible herding practices where you're not taking your livestock out when the lions, for example, are most active. You need to herd them when they're asleep. So there are ways that you can bring in sustainable sources of income into these communities without trophy hunting.
Michael, I have a question for you. You gave us the background and told us that these Obama-era bans were put in place only a few years ago. What happened before that? Was this something that was on the radar of Congress or past administrations?
African elephants have been protected under the Endangered Species Act in the U.S. since 1979. They've been regulated a long time, but the imports were allowed on a limited basis for decades. What changed is the rapid decline of the elephant population in parts of Africa around 2011-2012. 60% of forest elephants were gone during that time frame, and I don't have the statistics at hand of how many other elephants were gone, but it was that rapid decline, more than 50,000 elephants a year, that wildlife officials were responding to. That was seen as an unsustainable rate of loss. Now, you know, what some members of the council would present us is a binary choice between poaching, and that all the animals would be poached, or big game hunting, which does fund anti-poaching efforts. And so they present as you either have one or the other choices in that. But trophy hunting itself is not an insignificant number of individuals taken. Members of the Safari Club International, according to their own records, have taken more than 2,000 lions, 800 elephants, and 600 rhinos, which, you know, that does pale in comparison to the numbers being taken by poachers. But it does present an interesting ethical question of why people who are poaching for subsistence income, feeding a black market in rhino horn, is bad. And then trophy hunters who want to take that same rhino's body parts back to the United States and put it as a trophy in their home are good. And, you know, that's an interesting ethical dilemma to look at. Why is one type of killing okay and the other is not, if everyone agrees that we're trying to save these animals? And, you know, maybe both Masha and Chris could address that.
Dana's on our line from Columbia, Missouri. Thanks for joining us, Dana.
Hi, Kim. Thanks. A couple points I'd like to address about trophy hunting removing valuable sources of genetic diversity, which is absolutely true. The studies have shown this. The other thing is that targeting the oldest, most mature individuals with the greatest, quote, trophies, whether they're tusks or horns, these animals hold cultural knowledge about traditional pathways that these animals take to refuge during periodic droughts that may only happen every 10 to 20 years. So when we're pulling out those oldest individuals, like in elephants, they live in family groups of females, and younger males travel together, occasionally joined with older males. If they're in a period of drought and there are no older individuals who have that memory of a wetland refuge 50 miles away, that will lead to further population declines if they're not able to use the landscape the way that they should. If I could say one more thing about the Kruger National Park, it's a little bit misleading to think that it's such a success story. You know, there are no migratory herds there. This is essentially a fenced park. Mm. And so hunting in Kruger is a necessity to maintain healthy populations in a fixed area.
Chris, what do you say to Dana's comments?
I think you ought to ask the people in South Africa about whose farms and ranches you're going to take if you want migratory herds of elephants on the African continent. I think it's absurd. The notion that I think somebody said that we need to keep as many alive as possible gets to the heart of why the IWCC is formed. There's something like 400,000 elephant on the sub-Saharan continent. There may have been 5 million or 10 million at some point. I don't know. But is 800,000 the right number? If it is, then you have to find a place for those 400 or 500,000 elephant. And then you have to ask the people that are living there, who's going to be displaced? What humans are going to be asked to leave? And if you want free and wild ranging elephants. We don't have that here in the United States with bison, and nobody wants it. We have them corralled into parks, and it is a fact of the 21st century that with our human population, scientific community has to deal with wildlife management, and one of the tools they utilize is sport-regulated hunting. We determined 100 years ago, I think we were talking a minute ago, Michael was talking about what makes one form of killing bad and one form of killing good. And the answer is it's a solution derived by the scientific community because the illegal wildlife traffickers will kill every single animal of the population. That's where we were in the late 1800s in this country. Commercial utilization, unregulated trafficking in wildlife will drive them to extinction. The solution that we found 100 years ago was regulated sport hunting. And it is a fantastic success story. And yes, there is killing involved, but killing, death is a part of life. You know, there are 400,000 elephants. They're going to have babies, and there's going to be 40,000 more this year. What are we going to do with that population growth? The scientists that have been regulating these big species throughout the world for the last 100 years have the answer. And one of the tools that they want to use is regulated sport hunting.
Before we go, I want to give Masha one last question, which is there anything, is there any amount of hunting that can be allowed that you could back if this advisory board proposes it?
Well, we oppose all forms of trophy hunting for the reasons I've already stated and, of course, the moral objections we take to it. So ultimately, I would say no, but most urgently, we have to stop trophy hunting, threaten endangered species that are nearing extinction. But I don't have faith in this pro-trophy hunting council. I think this is a last-ditch attempt from a dying industry on its last breath to gain advantage with a friendly administration. And ultimately, I think the public opinion with 86% or more of the U.S. public opposing imports of trophies will win the day.
All right. Masha Kalinina from the Humane Society International, we appreciate you joining us today. And Chris Hudson of the International Wildlife Conservation Council, so glad to have you with us too. And Michael Biesecker with the Associated Press, we also thank you so much for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.